Joining us now on After Six, it is, I almost called you Representative Rob Sampson, but he's now Senator Rob Sampson, and he joins us every week on After Six. How are you, Rob?
Excellent. Excited to be here as always.
My goal with you, because you are libertarian, and I think of myself as being libertarian, but I've never actually gone to the doctor and had him put all the pins in me to see if I register as libertarian. So.
Right.
I think it's fun, the idea of us talking it through and seeing where the differences lie. And also because I just think libertarianism is where it's at in general, and more voters need to be exposed to it. So the president did something remarkable in the State of the Union address the other night with regard to staking out philosophical territory for his presidency and for the Republican Party and for the country. And one of the wonderful things about him doing that is that Republicans, one of the reasons I think Republicans lose a lot of ground to the Democrats on issues that have powerful philosophical underpinnings is because they don't articulate those underpinnings. So tell us about his comments the other night and your reaction, Rob Sampson.
Well, it's funny, Todd. You just brought up two things that I think are very closely related. The notion of identifying as a libertarian and the failure of the Republican Party to convey its message. I don't actually describe myself as a libertarian, hardly ever, even though a lot of other people might. And that is because if I take a look at the National Republican Party platform, I think I fit pretty neatly into that group. And I think that most people that identify as libertarians also do too. It is purely because they are upset with the failure of Republicans to convey those values in a committed and common sense way that they gravitate towards alternatives. And I think that's a mistake. I think that the strong, conservative, foundational, principle loving Republican Americans ought to stick to the party and be the ones driving that voice.
So what you're saying is if I refer to you as being a libertarian, that suggests a party difference rather than identifying your philosophy within the Republican brand.
Right.
So explain that to people, because I don't think most people get it.
Well, I mean, I suppose libertarian is an adjective that might describe somebody as leaning towards a pro-liberty stance. But I think that if you are looking at political parties, there is certainly a libertarian party that wants to claim that mantle. But to me, the only legitimate party that is associated with that is the Republican Party. And I don't believe that the Republican Party platform backs away from that in any way, shape, or form.
Isn't there a lot of social conservative stuff still in the platform?
I don't think it's a significant amount of anything. I really don't.
Okay. Is there anything else that Republicans tend to espouse? Because my sense of the National Party is they may have a plank that looks good, but they're also powerful people who are always in power in our federal government in some way. So they're complicit in the growth of government, in the ignoring of the Constitution and the principles that underpin it. So how do you deal with that aspect?
Well, I agree. I mean, just because there are people that self-identify as Republicans in our government that are failing to live by Republican values and ideals does not mean that the Republican Party and the definition of Republican is somehow flawed. It's the person that's flawed. I tend to identify as a Republican and uphold those values as much as I possibly can. And I think the president does, too, although there are a couple of instances where I think he's gone off the rails a little bit, certainly on the area of gun control. But he's a guy who was standing for the most significant core principles of the Republican Party, which is a love of country, the notion of freedom and opportunity outweighing free stuff or socialism. And I was so pleased to see him actually bring up the main issue of the day in the United States of America, and certainly in Connecticut, which is whether or not we are going down the road of socialism in this country.
Well, he issued a warning and also a line in the sand saying we will not become a socialist party, and he equated it with ideas of oppressive government, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Oh, yeah. And the reaction from some of the people who were sitting in the audience in the Democrat side of the room was shocking to me, that they seemed somehow horrified that that isn't a possibility, or that he would have the nerve to make such a statement.
Democrats sat on their hands when he said that there won't be socialism in this country, right?
Right. I think that they have trouble trying to rationalize that, because I think a lot of them, maybe to varying degrees, will state so publicly, but I think they ascribe to socialist ideas. And certainly here in our state, the Democratic Party has almost no people elected to state office that I would say fall into the category of being conservative or even moderate. They're all extremely far left liberal, and I think many of them are more than happy to go out and say that they are confirmed and proud to be socialists.
Do you really? Because I think that I feel that there's a lot of mission creep here, where this stuff, it gets pushed, and what they are is political animals, and they'll do whatever they have to do to win elections. And if that means there's an energized base that says Medicare for all, then they'll say, oh yeah, I'm for that, which national Democrats are saying now, ones who want to be viable for president, because we know people who want to be viable for president will say whatever. And I think that there's that same dynamic on the state level, where they know what the day-to-day combat of politics requires them to say, so they're not getting yelled at by their base. It's a way happier day as a politician to be yelled at by the opposing party than it is to be yelled at by people in your own party.
That's for sure. It's difficult to put people into any type of bucket and say this is what Democrats are today, this and that. I mean, they fall into different categories, just like Republicans or anyone else. When you're dealing with politics, I would say the sad state of affairs in politics is that it has become a situation where people who are elected and their constituents expect them to be elected to go serve the public for the purpose of making reasonable and common sense public policy for the good of the community and the future prosperity of our state or our country. And sadly, that's not why most people get elected to public office. And certainly once they get there, many of them immediately adapt to liking the job, and the focus is about preserving their electoral chances for the next time. And in the case of the Democrats in Connecticut, I think what they do is even one step further than that, which is every public policy that they come up with is designed for one purpose only, and that is to create some distance between the Democrats and the Republicans and advance their electoral chances by making policy that benefits them, regardless of the damage that might be done to the state in the process.
Yeah, so this has them doing things that clearly violate the concept of what America is supposed to be and what our constitutional premise is. And that's a really sad thing, because we are, you know, we've got these self-avowed socialists now in the Democratic Party who get the limelight in the party. The more inexperienced, the more vociferous they are in their anti-American statements, the more attention they get.
Right. We have a Connecticut state senator, a freshman Democrat, who put in a bill to tax ammunition at the rate of 50%, with some silly argument that it's on the notion of public safety. The purpose of that bill proposal is to get a reaction. It is to stand up and say, look at me, I despise the Constitution of the United States and the principles contained therein. Look at me.
Well, that's how you interpret it. I would say she's trying to virtue signal to her voters. I think I'm using that phrase.
That's the virtue that she's signaling.
Well, no, the virtue is that this is what we want. We know that people on the left, we all want gun control. She doesn't know anything about the Constitution, I would assume, but she's showing them that she's willing to do anything to perpetuate that idea and to try to get it further into law. And that helps her politically, wouldn't you say?
I would say that potentially, yes, because they are very, very effective at growing their base and creating more Democrats by convincing them of many, many non-truths, including that the United States of America is a terrible country with a horrible past, that it's racist and that it's bigoted, and that you cannot succeed if you were born in an inner city. These are all falsehoods that they perpetrate for the purpose of creating victims and then putting themselves in the position of being the saviors of those victims. But in the process, they keep them merely dependent on them staying in office so that they can maintain this equilibrium where there's more of them, taking care of their dependents than there are people who love America, freedom, and opportunity to outweigh them. And that's the focus of public policy making at the Connecticut legislature.
We're talking to Rob Sampson, newly elected and now practicing as a senator in the in that big, beautiful building in Hartford. And it's nice to have you on the Senate side of things. And you're more needed, I think, as a libertarian-leaning Republican so that you can articulate some of these issues. So let's talk more specifically about what it is that Democrats are pursuing. When they pursue things like endlessly higher taxes without regard for the inability to pay, when they are pursuing policies that help their voters but go against constitutional principles, what's the damage that's done?
Well, we're witnessing it right now. I mean, our state's economy is faltering while the rest of the country seems to be rebounding. And I think that's a result of the public policy that's been made over the last 8 years by the Malloy administration and the Democrats in Hartford. We have a reputation for being an anti-business state. I don't want to repeat a bunch of things that people already know, but they're just piling on. You know, a discussion about family medical leave or raising the minimum wage. I mean, the purpose of coming out with a policy idea like raising the minimum wage to $15 is simply intended to get the attention of a certain population that they want to get their votes from.
They want to ingratiate themselves with, yes. But what's wrong? Because the reason they come back to the minimum wage so often is because for people who aren't particularly interested in that as a policy, when they hear it, they say, that makes sense. There should be a minimum amount. Now, I don't know why it makes sense to them, but on some, I guess they connect emotionally. On a visceral level, it works for them, and they're not adamantly against it. I'm adamantly against it because, one, I don't want these people who at best are failed businessmen to be sitting around contemplating ways to put the government and the government's noses and eyes into their business and onto their spreadsheets. I don't want to see them coming in and checking to make sure that women are being paid as much as men, because you're opening the door to all kinds of things that go against the notions of liberty and a free society and a capitalist society. And capitalism is the thing that has made America so effective at changing so many lives.
It's the source of our prosperity, yes. But the reason why they do it, Todd, is because it perpetuates their class warfare argument in every way, shape, or form.
But I want to get you on the other side of that argument so that you can explain to the innocent victim of the empathy and compassion argument. Oh, we're compassionate. We want to give these people more money than they're worth in the marketplace. What's the pushback? How do you articulate an effective message against that?
Raising the minimum wage to an amount that will adversely impact our economy is certainly not the moral thing to do. It is certainly not the compassionate thing to do. And make no mistake, it is going to adversely impact our economy as a whole, and it will certainly impact that population that the Democrats are speaking to directly. Because, as simple as I can put it, people do not pay more for things than they are worth. People do not pay $100 for $50 dresses. They do not pay $20,000 for $10,000 cars, and they will not pay someone $15 an hour if the job is worth $10 an hour. People will adapt. There's no doubt about it. I mean, businesses will adapt. They will automate. They will determine what the job functions are for their employees, and they will change them. But the net result is that people that are in entry-level jobs are going to lose out. They're going to lose jobs. They're going to lose opportunities.
But I think Democrats acknowledge these issues that you're raising in objection to a minimum wage, and they admit that by moderating it. They realize, so for example, they've been pushed on this $15 talking point for a couple of years, and their answer is, yes, we're going to pass legislation for a $15 minimum wage, but they don't do it overnight. They know they have to ease in it, into it, and they also want to ease into it slowly enough that it actually isn't that big of a jump by the time it gets implemented. So they understand that it's bad policy. They're just trying to moderate it enough that it becomes not so damaging. So if it's moderated in that way, why would you object to it if it helps people?
I think there's no downside for them because they're going to make the argument for a higher minimum wage. I certainly think they are moderating the case for it because there are some intelligent members of that party who are suggesting to the more rabid socialist wing, hey, hold on, because we are going to damage the economy and we are responsible for running the state government right now. So let's hold off, folks. The other thing, though, is that I think that there's no downside for them because when this is implemented and people are left without jobs, who is going to come to their rescue then anyway? It's those same Democrats who are going to be in an opportunity to take care of
Yes. So now you're getting into the most insidious.
Population.
You're getting into the most insidious part of the argument. If they pass a $15 minimum wage and the bad things that we predict happen, more automation comes in. Fewer jobs are available. Young people have a tougher time getting jobs, and everybody else asks for a raise as well. That only creates more need for social programs, which they
That's
will
exactly
readily
correct.
Come in and argue
which
for.
Which is the ultimate goal anyway, and how anyone could argue that that's the moral side of this case or that's compassionate behavior is beyond me. I think it's immoral, and I think it's disgusting. And I am more than happy to be on the side of freedom and opportunity and not on the side of free stuff.
You see, that's Rob Sampson. That's why we love him as a state senator. So, yeah, I think that's true. I think taking it down the road to its natural conclusion offers clarification of how this works to the benefit of Democrats. Sure, we can trash the state, and they can look at it now and say, look at the destruction they've done to the state of Connecticut. They just won a big election. They can say there's no downside to the destruction that we reap as long as we keep our compassion argument deeply instilled into the psyches of our voters. You didn't want to react to that?
I have no reaction other than to say amen. That's exactly the way I would put it.
Yeah, so we're on the same page on this, which is interesting. I mean, it's good, but I was hoping maybe we'd find some little part of it that we could parse over. But this comes down to the beauty and the power of capitalism. And also, I think, maybe the larger argument that everybody can understand more clearly against this kind of politics that the left is practicing is that it really is a pay-to-play system. It is a graft-based system where special blocks of voters are identified, glorified by the party, and then benefited as a result of that. And if we look at Elizabeth Warren and her story this week about how she actually puts down on important documents under the word race, expecting her to self-identify, this white woman with some infinitesimal amount of Native American blood, according to her DNA test, self-identifies that her race is Native American. And she does this for the benefit that comes to her, that accrues to her for being part of one of the protected classes as designated by the left.
Absolutely. And I think it her entire success story is a lie from the word go. I think that she probably made a calculation to put that on a document early in her professional life and career, thinking it might give her some advantage. And when she saw that she was successful in deceiving people, she continued to do it over and over again. And I think that if she is not called out by fellow Democrats who espouse a tremendous amount of significance and weight to people's ethnic background and a desire for a correction in America for our perceived past ills, then that will just magnify their hypocrisy even further.
Rob Sampson, State Senator, thank you so much for your time. And it's always fun to talk with you. And we'll do it again next week, okay?
I would love that. Thank you.
All right, that's it for today's After Six. I'm Todd Feinberg, and stay tuned. We've got news and then the guy you love so much, you enjoy so much, Clark Howard, coming up after news on WTIC News Talk 1080.